You're listening to
Cattails. Hi, and welcome to another edition of Cattails. In this second tale of a two-part series, I chat more to founding member of Motorhead and current Pink Fairy, Lucas Fox. We chat about how Lucas cheated death and why he has no fear of the afterlife, how Warsaw Pact paved the way for Jack White and ended up in the Guinness Book of Records, and how Lucas worked with Ray Charles. We also talk about the early years of Motorhead, what it was like to leave the band, and what it was really like to work with Lemmy. There's no doubt that after hearing Lucas's tales, you'll be queuing up to read his autobiography. This is The Other One with Lucas Fox.
So it must have really upset you then when you had to, you know, leave Motorhead. I mean, that, from what I've read, was Lemmy's idea because of the drug situation that you've described there. That must have been heartbreaking.
It wasn't. It was a very strange one. I'm a raging asthmatic. This will sound like a weird side swipe to your question. Mm-hmm. It's a good question, and I'll reply to it. I'm a raging asthmatic, and I was born with allergies, serious allergies. So many times in life, from the age of, I don't know, 3 or 4, through to the age of 23, I died. Mm. And I woke up in hospital with a great big syringe stuck in my chest, pumping a pure adrenaline into my heart to get me back.
Oh, my goodness.
So yeah. And I saw the white light and out-of-body experience. I saw myself lying dead on the bed and stuff.
Oh,
from
amazing.
Above. You know, all those things that they talk about.
Yeah.
So in the end, anything that happens to me when I've had big, and I've had some serious slaps in the face in my life, this was just another one where as a kid I couldn't run, therefore people hit me and run away.
Yeah.
So I started having a gang, you know. So you know, I couldn't do sports the same as the other kids could, you know. That's why I rode horses. But again, I was allergic to, what was it, cats, dogs, horses, and eggs.
Oh.
Eggs was the worst one.
Oh, really?
Because you go for tea with your little pals or little girlfriends from school and then wake up in hospital the next day and I go, oh, God, yes, it was a cake.
You know? Oh, God.
In it. You know.
Oh, Lucas.
Yeah, yeah.
Amazing.
So,
oh, dear.
Yeah, right. So as I say, I always bounce back.
Yeah.
Which also gives me a lot of resilience and also gives me this devil-may-care attitude to life, where if somebody offers me something really stupid, I'm tempted to do it.
Oh, God. Oh, dear. I can see what's happened.
Ooh. Ooh. But as a result of lack of cash and that attitude, it's meant that I've done a million things more than I would have done otherwise.
Yes, yeah.
I work with Ray Charles, for instance, and Ray Charles, you know, like a day with Ray Charles
wow.
is like 6 months' education. And from that point of view, when you see somebody who's so severely handicapped with, you know, being blind, mm-hmm. and you realize that all his other senses have become honed to become these amazing, amazing antenna, to be able to pick up who's in the room and where they are geographically in the room, you know, not even from listening to them talk, he could sense where people were in the room around
wow.
him. And he would stick out his finger and point right between their eyes. He knew exactly where they were. Even though it's certain suddenly.
Amazing.
You know, so those sorts of things, having a handicap, a major handicap, meant also you develop other senses.
Mm.
But it's part of that vital thing in life to be able to A, survive, and more than survive, to live.
Yeah, it's that compensation
you know,
part, isn't it?
It's very much so, yeah. So kind of, I was this can sound corny, I was really born physically to lose.
So
as a result, it gave me so much more impetus to want to win.
Yes, yeah.
Whatever
yeah.
that means.
No, I get that. I mean, I think it's absolutely fascinating that you've been through these near-death experiences on a repeated basis when you were young. I mean, that's, you know, the white light as described by many people in those scenarios and out-of-body experiences are well-recorded, aren't they? So to actually hear somebody who's mm. actually experienced that is quite amazing.
Yeah, and a bit like meeting the Who or whatever, seeing the Who in Chiswick High Road, it being normal to me because it was part of my life.
Yeah.
I mean, when I was a baby, there were no, you know, Ventolin, you know, the inhalers?
Yes.
You know, the puffer?
Yeah, yeah.
They didn't exist then. Mm. And the only thing that my parents found which worked to get me to sleep when I had an asthma attack coming on was hot blackcurrant and rum.
Oh, dear.
So I So I spent a lot of my baby years staring at the moon at night, not sleeping, wheezing and drunk.
And drunk. Basically. And things haven't changed.
Exactly. And like everybody in those days, my parents chain smoked, and we used to go to the country to my grandfather's vicarage every weekend, because my father had an allotment there and could grow our own vegetables and stuff like that, so it was useful. But I'd be in the country, and I say staring at the moon, listening to the foxes bark.
Wow!
so that was part of my life. I'm very much a night bird. I love the night.
Yeah.
I write a lot at night. You know, I'm writing my book at the moment.
Yeah, sounds. I read that you were actually doing that. Sounds a lot to go in it, doesn't it? Really, I mean, you've got so many stories to put in there. You're going to need a whole series of them, I think.
Well, I think that's probably what's going to happen. If I'm trying to get the first one off the ground first, but basically, I think it's going to be a series. Yeah. And yeah. I'm really enjoying writing. It's great fun. I don't know. You must have read loads of autobiographies and stuff of including life, Keith Richards, etc. Yeah. And I loved Life. I thought it was a great book. The first three quarters anyway, and I got bored at the end. But did you notice that there were two bits missing?
Right. Okay. Tell
in
me.
That book. Tell me. And all the books. We got lots of rock and roll, right?
Yeah.
There we were. You know. I tuned up my. I only had five strings on my guitar. Open tuning, all that. Great. Mm-hmm. We recorded. We went to the studio and recorded it. Great. We went out on tour. Blah 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 blah. Great. But it's a bit like listening to a footballer, you know.
Yeah.
Oh yes. No. Basically, you just do your job.
Yeah.
But the bit that's missing, which was so preeminent in our lives, was the sex and the drugs.
Mm.
And it hardly gets a look in, even in Keith's book.
Yeah.
You know, as a raging junkie, heroin junkie, there's no descriptions in there of what it was like to be playing guitar out of his fucking mind.
Mm.
And we all know that there was a lot of sex going on.
Yeah.
And there's no descriptions of it.
Yeah.
And from a very early age, like with Lindgery, I've always been very into erotic literature.
Mm-hmm.
And Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, you know that book?
Yeah.
Chris Thompson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's a great way of writing about drugs. So I'm writing about not just the glamour side, but also the scuzzy side, the failures, also of my own failures. I've had so many of them in my life. And as Churchill said, you know, success doesn't last. Failure doesn't kill you. The essence is to keep going. And that's my... That's definitely my motto.
I
dislike Churchill for so many things. I just loved his vernacular, his way of seeing things, and his way of his verb.
He was superb. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're intending on saying it all?
No,
then?
Oh gosh, yes.
Good. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
As you say, people don't do that, do they?
In real detail, you know, what it's like to have a blowjob under the table in a speakeasy in a restaurant full of people without other people knowing. All that stuff. And of course, it's funny because, you know, there you are sitting in a restaurant having a blowjob under the table. And you know, the waitress who you know really well is coming up saying, do you want to wait to order before your girlfriend gets back from the loo? And I thought, yeah, no, that's all right. I'll order champagne, please.
No. You know,
feeling the girl's mouth freeze as the waitress is there. So yes, I'm going into all the detail because it's reality, well, the way it happens.
Yeah, and that's what the normal, let's say, everyday life of the general public doesn't have those kind of experiences, do they, in the same way that the rock and roll industry does. So it's good to be able to tell it all rather than just, as you say, the bits that are the public bits, shall we say.
Yeah. Absolutely. If I could, I'd have little sachets that you could break open to smell what a squat smelled like. Because I'm really going into the detail of you know, cockroaches on the wall and sink piled with dishes with half finished food with dog ends stuck in them. You know, the whole thing about the dealers and the squats as Nottingham Gate was. You see.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think everybody who's read the chapters I've written, I just loved it. They go, oh, gotcha, yeah, fucking great. And I'm talking very directly to one person, the reader.
Yeah.
And literally saying, you are walking into the speakeasy, you walk through the corridor and down the stairs into the coffin on your right, and, you know, the whole description as to what it felt like to go in the speakeasy, you know.
Yeah.
And there's lots of scenes in the speakeasy.
Brilliant.
So I'm going for the full Monty on this.
Wow. And when's this going to be out then, Lucas? Because that sounds a fascinating read. I'm sure loads of people are going to want to get their hands on.
I don't know. My goal is obviously to have it ready for the biopic, that period.
Right.
Which could be next May. Mm-hmm. Then it's by biopic, which is meant to be coming out.
Yeah.
And there's releases and stuff like that going on around the same period and before that. And I've actually got a radio show in France as well, which has been very well received, mm-hmm. show, which I'm doing, which gets that every Saturday.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of bits and pieces happening in the moment, which is lovely, you know. Somebody who doesn't know me very well asked me about, what are you going to do about retirement? And I just looked at them like they're completely mad. I thought, that's never crossed my mind.
Mm.
It's never even entered in. I don't even understand the word. You know?
and why would you?
the idea of sitting. No, why would I? Because there's always something to be done.
Yes.
You know, always, yeah. You know. So I'm writing songs at the moment. Well, you know about the Pink Fairy.
I do, yes. Yeah, that was just a couple of years ago, wasn't it, that came out? Resilient Reptiles, yeah.
Mm.
And of course, you wrote all of it, bar one track on there.
Yeah, which is because, you know, it was that thing of you know, they'd started sending me bits of songs, mm-hmm. which sounded great, fucking great. I thought, yeah, this is going to be a great album. And that's Paul Rudolph and Alan Davey. And I sort of said, after about 3 weeks of this, I said, this is going to be great. We're going to have a great time. Has anybody got any words, you know, melodies and stuff? And I got sort of got rather embarrassed silence back, saying, well, we've actually been writing for the last 30 years and we're a bit dried up. If you've got any ideas, go for it.
Uh-huh.
So I just started going for it. And I think 5 songs came out in 3 or 4 weeks.
Wow.
And then I wrote another 3 or 4 when I was in Austin, in Texas.
Brilliant.
Just because I was just so inspired, you know, out there on the motorway, Motel 6,
mm-hmm.
Again with the cockroaches and all that. It's great, you know, the stuff in there, which is just, you know, perfect Raymond Chandler writing, you know, detective stories and all that stuff, which I've always loved. The Big Sleep, you know, all the, you know, Bogey and Bacow and all that stuff. I just always loved that. You know, so they're little stories on their own, just like the Kinks write. You know, Ray Davies is writing, I adore.
Yeah,
you know, of all that Muswell Hillbilly stuff. But you know, you're just writing really, you know, real little songs which are a story in their own right, sort of thing.
Yes, yeah.
So that's how I'm writing as well.
Amazing. And is that going to be a
weird edge to it?
Is that going to be a Pink Fairies album, or is that going to be a different?
No. No, it's going to be different. There's a producer in Paris who wants me to record 5 tracks with him, and he's going to be doing the music, and I'm going to be doing melodies and vocals and singing and stuff. Because everyone, you know, I've been singing for years, and just haven't got really round to doing the singing much.
Yeah.
But that was what turned me on with Pink Fairies, because once we recorded the backing tracks and all that stuff, then I had to place the vocals at whoever was going to sing it. I was really hoping it would be Larry Wallace who'd be singing it.
Right.
And every time I finished a song, I sent it to Larry, and he loved the lyric. But finally, it didn't end up doing it, didn't end up singing it. But I wanted Larry to sing it, because Larry's got such a wonderful Walworth Road, South London whine, sounding like a sort of that London Alice Cooper. And I thought that would have been absolutely perfect for this album, and it would have been, but it just wasn't to be. It's the way it went. So I ended up singing all the guide vocals,
right,
with hefty amounts of bourbon, and I had a great time. It's lovely. And I thought, fuck yeah, I'm going to be able to do this. You know,
brilliant.
Whereas up until then, it has always been. I've really never taken the time to concentrate on playing guitar. Although I play guitar well, but not enough to play a whole song.
Yeah,
you know, I've always gone into the studio and recorded bits and put it together.
Right.
You know, likewise bits of bass or piano, and love all that.
Yeah.
And singing, I'd always done a lot of backing vocals, and had a kind of character vocal, I suppose. You know, I know I've got a voice which seduces people. You know, it's part of the weaponry that I've got a good voice. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So it works well on radio, works well in interviews and stuff.
Yeah.
And I've done a lot of voiceovers in the past as well. again, these sort of things that you pop up and you need money, and he says, could you do a voiceover? And I end up doing 52 minutes on Egyptology, you know, with Kalakas and Ramses too, and all this stuff.
Terrific.
So
that's great.
It's just been such a weird life from that point of view. And I've never thought of it, because I always move forward.
Mm.
I don't look back. It's only that now I'm writing this book or series or whatever, that I'm suddenly going back into it all.
Mm.
And that kind of started with the last time I saw Lemmy.
Right.
Was at the Zenith in Paris. And I hadn't seen him for years, and I was a bit nervous. So the publishing company, Notting Hill Music, are wonderful. Were publishing his songs at the time as well. So through Notting Hill Music, they got me the passes and stuff. So I turned up with Zenith and his Skin, Siskin, Damned, Motorhead. Great gig.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was standing in the invite queue or whatever, they handed me an envelope, and in the corner it was written two little letters LK.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew I was on Lemmy's personal list.
Oh.
And so after the gig, with my backstage pass and all the rest of it, I went into the backstage, and the American guy running the backstage came up and said, Lucas, it's good to know you're here. Let me know you're here. He's looking forward to seeing you. You're going to have time with him. There's no problem. And by the way, the chef is over there. Anything you'd like to eat in the world, he's a great chef. He knows you're here too. You know, so just walk up and help yourself to any drink you want. If you need serving, just you know, put your hand up. We'll be looking after you. And just by the way, everybody in this backstage realizes and knows, if you hadn't been there for Lemmy in 1975, there would have been no Motorhead.
Yeah.
Now that had never crossed my mind.
Really?
Because I knew that when Lemmy got thrown out of Hawkwind, I went and picked him up at the airport.
Yeah.
At Heathrow. And he was a car crash. He really was. He was in a terrible state. And we'd been hanging out for so long, he trusted me and we could, you know, be comfortable together. And basically for 3 weeks, he trashed everything in the flat around us and stuff, and was in a terrible state.
Mm.
But it had never crossed his mind that he'd gone bad, because he was happy in Hawkwind. He was happy being a sideman who had all the star status, because he sang Silver Machine.
Yeah.
Therefore, he was getting lots of interviews, lots of, you know, photo opportunities, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Lots of girls. He had everything he needed. All he had to do was turn up at the gig.
Yeah.
They didn't really rehearse much, you see.
Mm.
So he was happy being a sideman. It never crossed his mind to want to have the responsibility of a whole fucking band to look after,
mm,
and to make sure that it's good, staying successful, and, you know, writing all the songs to make sure it's successful, and album after album, doing what you have to do, you know, etc. That never crossed his mind. And as it turned out, I'm in touch with Doug Smith, who was the manager at the time, who was Hawkwind's manager and then Motorhead's manager. And we had a long chat about this recently. And he said, well, that's funny, because Doug was working on Lemmy on his side every time Lemmy came into the office, and I was working on Lemmy on my side, saying, well, listen, Len, come on. Now, I'm a drummer, you're a bass player. You know, yeah, but I don't want to know. No, listen, if Phil Linnett can do it as a singing bass player, you can front the band too. And, well, no, all like this, you know. And it went on for weeks, until finally I went around there. Well, you're late. We've got to go and sign a management deal and a record deal, and, you know, and that was it. We began, you know. And as soon as we started, it was just me and Len at the beginning.
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
And we spent quite a long time working on the imagery, which, of course, we've been talking about,
yeah,
with our discussions about the Second World War, the elite regiments and all that stuff.
Sure.
And up until then, he'd been wearing long fringe jackets and, you know, the kind of, you know, hippie stuff.
Yeah.
And because he'd finally turned the page on Hawkwind, he wanted something different.
Mm.
So there we were, you know, getting, we had leather jackets and started buying stuff in Portobello Market. And I got my girlfriend Ina, who's Latvian at the time, to embroider Motorhead on blank armbands and stuff.
Mm.
And so, you know, buying iron crosses and all that stuff was a deliberate anti-establishment approach.
Yeah.
Skulls weren't used at the time either. I actually had a skull earring, and so all of that came.
Right.
So the imagery started coming together. Lemmy wanted mirror glasses so people couldn't see our eyes, so that was cool. Lemmy gave me my first pair of cowboy boots that he had.
Yeah.
I had a pair of white cowboy boots, jeans, leather jacket, festooned with various bits of Nazi regalia. which was absolutely anti-Nazi. There was no question of any racism there, either from Lemmy or from me, because, you know, me the way I am, you know me now. And Lemmy particularly the same way, you know, the love of his life was a black girl, you know. So it wasn't that. It was literally the anti-establishment thing that we'd had enough of being told what heroes we were and, you know, all the rest of it. And he was punk before punk.
Yeah.
And, of course, McLaren and Westwood picked up on that.
Yeah.
And, you know, with Sex and all those shops they had, picked up on the Motorhead imagery and attitude. Mm. I'm not saying that we created punk at all. All I'm saying is that we were all in the same kind of vernacular or the same kind of mindset.
Yeah, the time was
and
right
that
for
was
it,
six
wasn't
months
it?
Later, you see.
Wow.
Because 76 is when punk kicked off.
Yeah. Was,
you know, and again, there were only three bands that went through punk without getting a wrinkle. Was Hawkwind, Pink Fairies, and Motorhead.
Yeah.
All the others looked old-fashioned because all the others had been, living in mansions as millionaires and taking 6 months to 2 years to record an album. And we were going short, sharp shock songs, and as soon as you finish one song, you don't wait for too much applause. You just hammer into them the next one, relentlessly driving it home.
Yeah.
And that's what we wanted to do. You know, it was MC5, it was Link Ray, it was the Beatles, of course. But early Beatles, Star Club era Beatles with Lennon and his vocal. The Who, of course. The Ox, you know, John Entwistle's bass sound was something we were both obsessed with. Keith Moon's style of explosive drumming was something I was very into. Lots of Tom work and stuff. So it all kind of fell into place naturally. That it was something that both of us, we both had this mental sound image in our brains, but the Flaming Groovies, the Stooges, none of those bands were successful or even known of by most people in those days.
Yeah.
And we were going back to the English Birds with Ronnie Wood in them. Yeah. We were going back to the rock and roll era, you know, of that sort of the funky end of rock and roll, rockabilly as well, and of course the Beatles, you know, heavy influence. We used to sing Beatles songs when we were together all the time, you know, he'd be on his acoustic guitar. And this is another thing about Lemmy, is that most people don't think of how intelligent he was. He's one of the most intelligent men I've ever worked with. Really brilliant, you know, absolutely brilliant. And a big reader. He always had books on the go. He's a very big reader. And his lyrics are just stupendous, you know. The way he writes with the humour he has. It's, walking like a parallelogram, excuse me. Goes up like prices at Christmas. Goes up like prices at Christmas.
Yeah,
you know, isn't that a wonderful phrase?
Terrific.
You know, speed goes up your nose like prices at Christmas. And of course, Motorhead meant speed freak. The word Motorhead meant speed freak.
Right.
And so because he'd written the B-side of the last single that Hawkwind released with him in the band, he'd written the B-side. And I remember he was skipping down the street like a schoolgirl saying, I do like to be, see me on the B-side. You know, he's obviously going to get 50% royalties, you know.
Lovely.
Oh, dear.
Amazing.
We're going to take a quick break now and hear a bit more of you playing with the Pink Fairies. This one's called Whipping Boy.
I don't
This is Lucas Fox, founding drummer of Motorhead with Lemmy, and you're listening to Cat Tales.
Amazing stories. So, to looking back on those days then, do you feel like, you know, oh, if only things had been different? Because, of course, after, you know, that 6 months of you being in the band, it then kind of exploded for them and their massive, massive success happened, didn't it? Do you have a regret about all that?
Yes. No. It's really not in my being that holds regrets or grudges. It's not the way I function.
Yeah.
It's a bit like... you know when you're desperately in love, okay? Mm-hmm. This is a parallel, but it's a good one.
Yeah.
And if somebody, if my girlfriend says, look, it's over, I'm no longer in love with you, you can't hang on to that.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, grow a pair and move on.
Yeah, good analogy.
Otherwise, you're being a fucking masochist. Being a fucking masochist, and I'm not. Mm. And neither a sadist nor a masochist. So I'm not going to force myself on a situation where I'm not wanted.
Mm. Yeah.
So you just have to grow a pair and go, well, move on, pal.
Yeah. If
that's what it was.
Yeah.
And you move on to the next thing.
Yeah, of course.
So no, it's the contrary. You know, Filthy did a wonderful job. Wonderful job.
Yeah.
Incredible job. He was the ideal Motorhead drummer. He sounded like four Harley Davidsons on amphetamine.
That's true.
It was fucking great. And Phil was a great guy, very, very witty, nice guy, and fidgeting with Lem and Larry at the beginning, and then Larry left, and then with Fast Eddie. And that for me is still the perfect combination of all Motorhead, those three.
Yeah.
But as I say, when I finally got to Rockfield to record that album, we'd been through so much on the 16-day tour, and it was great. We did some storming gigs, it's fucking great, and even the Hammersmith Odeon gig, which was a complete nightmare. I'm in touch with quite a lot of fans who've contacted me and said, look, I was there. And I thought, oh, were you? Great. I need to know your story so that I can write from your point of view as well as from what it was like on stage.
Yeah.
And then even that, everybody loved it. You know, because again, it was that kind of garage rock.
Yeah.
It was rock and roll. It was, you know, we did rock and roll, you know, and it's that with the punk edge. You see, it had to be dangerous. It had to be on the edge of falling apart all the time. What it became after that, if you like, we created Lemmy and I, whatever order you like, created something that never existed before.
Yeah,
and we spat out what our influences were, mixed with the gel that happened between the three of us. And it became this animal that it became. And then, frankly, Phil and Eddie had half of the work already done because the sound, the original sound was already there.
Yeah.
There was already la matière. There was already, like cooking or something, there was already the basic dish was there.
Yeah.
So when you listen to the recordings on Parole, you can actually hear my snare drum on the first half of every track of the original recording.
Right, okay.
And Phil's drumming is overdubbed on the track.
Yes.
But the way we recorded it, Dave Edmunds set up the mics as a very live recording. My drums were pissing down the guitar mic, the bass mic, and the guide vocal mic.
Right.
So if you think about it technically, you can't actually really mix that out.
No.
Without taking out part of the sound, you see. So, yeah. So I'm on, apart from the re-record, because they re-recorded the whole thing later, but on the original On Parole, I'm actually on all those tracks.
Yes, yeah. And that's probably the ingredients,
so
you see. That's the magic bit.
And therefore you've got the ginger, you've got the red hot peppers, you've got the, you know, the basic ingredients of the dish are there.
Yeah.
And when it came to being in Rockfield at the time, with the amount of amphetamine I had in my head, I played it pretty safe. I was not doing what I'd done on tour for those 16 days.
Yeah.
I played it pretty safe because I wanted to go down and go down properly, which is what happened.
Yeah.
And then all the wonderful frilly bits, Filthy added on top, which was brilliant. Fucking great. What a great drummer. Love it. And of course, you know, Filthy was playing on my kit as well.
Right. Okay.
My kit was still set up in Rockfield.
Terrific.
The only thing he did do was change the snare drum for his snare drum.
Right.
But the tom tab, which is what, this lovely old vintage Ludwig kit, which I bought off the Four Tops, which originally, for most of the tour, was pink champagne colour, until I had the whole thing made into the black kit, which was a few photos of that. And all the chromeware was then black. Sat in black.
Yeah, brilliant.
And you couldn't see the kit on stage. It was really haunting. It was a beautiful kit. So all you saw were the symbols.
Yeah.
And the sort of glimmer of the blackness. It was just an amazing kit. Oh. And it sounded great because the shells were really thick. Good old Ludwig American handmade kit. You know, it's a beauty. Fucking beauty.
Brilliant.
And so that's the kit that's on now with my sound, with, you know, the way I tune the toms down to fit between Lemmy and Larry, which is what I did actually on the Pink Fairies album. I did the same tuning as I did on that original Motörhead on Parole album.
Oh, right.
The same tuning. So as a result, the sound of the toms actually splices into Alan Davies' sound.
Right.
Of course, Alan Davies was taken under Lemmy's wing. You know that story, don't you?
No, I don't.
But Alan Davies walked up to Lemmy after a gig, and he had his bass with him, his Rickenbacker.
Yeah.
And he put on, and he said, Lemmy, I know how to play everything you've ever played. And Lemmy went, yeah, right, you know, okay, plug in, show me. And sure enough, and Lemmy was welling up. He was so touched that somebody had actually, not just, and it wasn't just copying him. He really understood the whole feeling and the way of playing. Alan Davies is a phenomenal bass player. And of course, he's picked up that Lemmy torch and take it one stage further.
Amazing.
To all the stuff, I mean, he's been Hawkwind for 20 years. So Lemmy took him under his wing and taught him shitloads of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and Alan and Lemmy became very, very close. And when it came to be out in Texas, in Austin, and Alan and I obviously had Lemmy in common, and Paul Rudolph had been living with John Manley, Johnny Walker from Warsaw Pact, for 7 years. And therefore, we had my rhythm guitarist from Warsaw Pact in common.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the three of us gelled immediately.
Fabulous.
It was just like, you know, putting on a nice old pair of socks. You were completely comfortable with each other.
Yeah. And you need that, don't you?
And of course, we had all... Yeah. Mm. Well, it was just immediate gel, you know.
Did you actually stay in touch with Lemmy after Motörhead's sort of... Well, your departure, should we say, from Motörhead?
Yes, yeah. Well, all the bands that I was in after Motörhead, ones that gigged, he came down and saw them.
Yeah.
And loved them.
Oh,
the Untouchables with Skid Marks and stuff. And Stevie Lewins from the Count Bitters, came down and saw us play at Dingwalls loads of times. Who else? All sorts of other bands. I think he even came and saw White Lightning. That was a great band, White Lightning. That was Carl Grossman who wrote the first hit for Status Quo, Going Down the Dustpipe, which of course is an Australian song about the dustpipe, which is when you're driving across the desert. You create a dust pipe behind you.
Mm.
So you're going down the dust pipe. It's an Australian song, not a British song.
Brilliant.
In that sense. And so I worked with Carl a lot. We worked together as a good unit and put a band together. And Carl was signed to Ringo Records.
Yeah.
Where I met Ringo quite a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Because the settlement hadn't been done between John Lennon and Paul McCartney, the only people that were allowed to use the Beatles studios, their own studios, were people who were signed to their labels.
Right.
So we got to do all the demos in the basement of Savile Row. Remember the last gig was on the roof?
Yeah, absolutely.
In the basement with this wonderful studio. Then we moved on to Good Earth to do all the backing tracks with Tony Visconti's studio.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, Carlos Alomar sitting in on some of the tracks playing guitar. But Robin and Diva, Stevie Wonder's backing vocalists on some of the tracks. It was just a phenomenal, what an experience. Spent 3 months or so doing that.
Amazing.
And then we moved to do lots of overdubs out to Titmuss Park, which was Ringo's house that he bought off John Lennon. And it's the house you see in Imagine, you know, Imagine.
Yeah, I do.
Where you see Yoko opening the shutters. That's Titmuss Park. So we spent weeks there inside the Beatles, which of course, you know, excuse me, pinch me, this is not real. As it says over the door, this is not here, you know.
Yeah.
And so, and we had the Beatles back line to tour with.
Fabulous.
The Ampeg Beatles back line.
Amazing.
So those are the sort of experience where you go, well, do you regret Motörhead? Well, no, because I'm moving forward.
Yeah.
Obviously moving forward, you know. And the Warsaw Pact, what a great band that was. You know, and doing the fastest album ever, you know, the one we started recording at 10 o'clock at night or something, and 11 o'clock the next morning. We spent all night on speed making the covers, stamping the covers with stamps and sticking stickers in the covers and signing them and stuff. And next morning we were in Virgin Music or whatever it's called, Virgin Record Store at Marble Arch, signing them.
Crikey.
And
that's
the,
fast.
The album was done directly and nothing existed before 10 o'clock at night. Nothing, not even the covers.
Oh, that's amazing.
So we literally... That's how we got into the Guinness Book of Records. Not that we wanted to, but that's how it became the fastest album ever recorded.
Deary me.
And, of course, the record companies and the studios ganged up on us. Because, imagine, we're in punk new wave.
Yeah.
And, of course, this was the instant album, which, of course, was totally punk in attitude.
Yes.
Recording direct to disc.
Yeah.
And it's only recently that Jack White tried to do the same thing, recording direct to disc. And you get so much dynamics. I mean, there's five or six tracks on the YouTube from that recording, which are, and a real good band live as well.
Yeah.
You know, they're playing the Red Cow, and we'll be supporting Susan the Banshees at Oxford Uni and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's a great band. And I'm in touch with Andy, Andy Calhoun, very close. And, of course, I'm back in touch with Brian James, because we're very, very close in the day as well.
Yeah.
Brian James from The Damned.
Yes.
Tony James from Generation X.
Yeah.
Of course, all of them would say, you know, well, the reason why they started playing was because they'd seen Hawkwind or Pink Fairies or Motorhead or all
three. Yeah, amazing. And isn't that great to be part of that legacy?
It's like that Pete Frame family tree thing, you know, that it's kind of incestuous, but we're all living in Nuffield Gate.
Yeah.
We're all hanging out in the same pubs, you know, and with Lemmy in the Day or with the Warsaw Pact or White Lightning, you know, it was nothing okay, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I was living between, three or four flats there. I think it was All Saints Road, and then we had offices later with the Sisters of Mercy. It was Blenheim Crescent, 72 Blenheim Crescent, and then I think it's Lancaster Road, and then Westmore Park Road. Wow. So that's my stamping ground in London. Mm. That's also why I chose Mormouth. Mm. Mormouth is kind of a little bit similar in that sense.
Yeah.
But it's got a very big arty feeling to it.
Yeah.
It's also, you know, all the stars that live around here are completely ignored, which is perfect.
Yeah.
So I don't get bothered, not that I'm a star, but I mean, you know, I like my anonymity, you know.
Yes, yeah, sure.
I like to be able to step into the spotlight, that's fun, but basically when I'm not in the spotlight, I like to have my own life separate to it, you know.
Yeah, behind those thick walls.
Behind those thick walls, yes. Exactly. Getting up to the skullduggery I get up to.
Yes.
Got great things, actually. hooks and pulleys on the beams, that's what it is.
Oh, Lucas, you know, it's been absolutely fabulous talking. I could talk all day, but of course, I'm sure that you've got better things to do.
My pleasure, Kat.
Oh.
Nice to know you. Nice to be in touch.
Yes, absolutely. Lovely. And you take care, won't you? And I'll speak soon, Lucas. Thank you very much. See you.
My pleasure, Kat.
Thank you.
Take care of yourself, love.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Bye.
Bye, love. You've been listening to Kat.
To listen again to this and other tales, go to cattails.co.uk.